Welcome to the T&D podcast brought to you by TomTom. We think you're trucking awesome. You deserve a trucking awesome app. That's why today we're excited to talk about the ultimate trucking companion, TomTom Go Navigation. With premium features designed to make every delivery a breeze, Go Navigation ensures you reach your destination efficiently and stress-free.
Matt Ireland here for the Truck and Driver podcast. I'm sat today with my good friend Paul Rowlands, and we're just going to have a bit of a chat about his life in transport and how he ended up being a Middle East driver and so on and so forth before and afterwards. So, hello, Paul.
Morning, Matthew boy. All right.
I'm very good, mate. How are you?
Good stuff. Yeah, very good for an old man.
Yeah.
Thanks. So, the podcast about my life in transport.
Yeah.
I've mostly written it down, so
it's fine.
I'm sure I'll read it out really more. We'll see how it goes anyway, shall we?
Well, you are an author, so I wouldn't expect anything else.
Yes, an author, yes. Yeah. Ian Paul Rowlands, date of birth, 8th of March, 1947. And if my maths are correct, it makes me 77 years of age.
Crikey
indeed. Born in Tonpentra in the Rhondda Valley, in what I understand to have been the coldest winter for 100 years. And due to the depth of snow, my father was unable to collect me and my mother from Glencornell Hospital for 6 days. He was a fitter in the MT, which is the motor transport section of the RAF. And due to Britain ruling, I'll put that in inverted commas, as I'm not sure of the correctness of the word these days. Anyway, ruling a good proportion of the globe, we as a family spent most of my young life in 2.5 year postings to various far-flung places in the empire. And I can only assume that this constant moving from one destination to another is the reason that travel became such an important factor in my life. When I was one, my mother, who had never previously left the boundaries of the county of Glamorgan, was required to pack me up, along with a large bundle of old terry toweling nappies, and make her way out to join my father at RAF Heaney, an RAF camp on the outskirts of Bulawayo in what was then southern Rhodesia.
Which is what now is Zimbabwe, isn't it?
Which is now Zimbabwe, yes. For those of you who are not aware of what a terry nappy was, we didn't have such modern contrivances as disposable nappies back then.
Plastic disposable nappies.
Plastic, oh, that's true, yeah. Plastic. Oh no. Your child did a poo in a type of toweling material wrapped around your undercarriage in a liner and held together with large nappy pins. These the mother had to clean after usage by the child. Not always the most pleasant of experiences, and then boil washed ready for the next time, and this could happen as often as 5 times a day. She must have been some intrepid young lady, my mum, as it involved making her way by train via Cardiff and Bristol to Southampton, followed by a 3-week ocean-going voyage to Cape Town in South Africa, and then a 3-day journey in a second-class compartment to Bulawayo. All this less than 2 years after the end of the Second World War. Not bad for a 26-year-old girl from the Welsh Valleys who had never been further south than Pontypridd. Cleaning and changing my constantly filled toweling nappies was the most difficult and weightiest problem she had to deal with, she reckoned. During Dad's posting there, he was required to take up a 6-month temporary detachment at RAF Eastleigh, near Nairobi in Kenya, which involved taking a convoy of 4 Austin K6 10-tonners from Bulawayo, the 3,000 kilometres across what are now the well-known game reserves of Central Africa, to his new posting. My mother demanded to accompany him, as she wasn't going to be left to fend for herself in Heaney. As if I now 2.5-year-old, I have no memory of the trip, but apparently it took 10 days across what is basically semi-arid tracked grassland, with not a yard of asphalt road until the outskirts of Nairobi. Sleeping out at night was done under canvas with a guard. Anyway, at the end of the posting, Mother, on finding out that she was pregnant with my brother, Stuart, refused point blank to make the return journey overland, as with the non-stop bouncing about of the vehicles, who knows when the new baby might have decided to enter the world. And Dad had to organise a flight back in an RAF plane that was making the return journey a week or so earlier. This, I suppose, was my introduction to the love of long-distance overland travel, although, of course, I didn't know it at the time. Over the next 15 years, we did stints in camps all over the place, but mostly Europe, with time spent in Germany, Holland, Malta, Cyprus, interspersed with postings to the occasional RAF camp in the UK. Fortunately, whilst posted abroad, my father, who fought in the North African campaign in the Second World War, was keen to utilise the opportunities provided by this almost gypsy lifestyle to venture out and explore the continent, and in the 1950s purchased a brand new frame tent and a Ford Consul car, and we joined the fashion of the time in Europe, touring the camping hotspots of Switzerland, Italy, France and Austria. For these holiday jaunts, my mother was issued with a fold-up map of the continent and expected to guide my dad in the direction he wished to go. This is where my enthusiasm for travel came into its own, as Mum hadn't the foggiest idea of how to read a map. So the responsibility was handed over to me. I took to it like a duck to water. At age 10, was happily informing Father as to which autobahn ausfahrt to take next. Anyway, in 1961, our penultimate posting was to RAF Salita, where I finished my education at the infamous Changi Grammar School, and which is in Singapore. And after the usual 2.5 year cycle, at age 17, we returned to RAF Wadisham in Suffolk, where I finally left home 6 months later to commence my working life in the Ordnance Survey headquarters in Chessington. Not transport based at all, other than we made maps. I loved the independence of living away from home, but my abiding memory of the 18 months I spent there was the 4 week long holiday me and three good friends took travelling around Europe, camping as we went. Once again, I was entrusted with a fold-up map. By this time, I'd become something of an expert, and the whole trip only reinforced the passion burning inside for the need to travel. That same year, 1966, my father was killed in an accident, not travel-related, and being the eldest son, assumed it was my responsibility to return home and become the man of the house. A civil service transfer to the Inland Revenue in Ipswich saw me moved back to a little village called Battersford, where my mother wasn't having any of me wearing the trousers, so to speak. She was more than adequately able to fulfil that role, thank you very much. As she didn't drive, and the local bus service was non-existent, she offered to buy me a car, as long as I took her into town at weekends, should I pass my test. £65, purchased a solid, reliable Hillman Husky, and with me taking the old jalopy out...
Jalopy.
And me taking the old jalopy out on my own at every available opportunity, with just a provisional license to my name, a couple of months of freewheeling around the country lanes, and three lessons later, I had passed. That very same evening, I picked up an old friend, Tom Wilding, and we headed off to Watford Gap Services. Why, I don't know. But it had been on the news recently for some reason or other, and as the song Cumberland Gap sounded really cool, so maybe Watford Gap was as well. To say it was a disappointment wouldn't be far off the truth, not realising that in years to come I would expressly avoid stopping there once my professional driving career took off.
I don't think anyone's ever thought of Watford Gap as exciting or exotic, have they?
No, absolutely not. To say it was disappointing, it was. I won't say it put me off the idea of driving, but this is what it's all about. Anyway, as much as I enjoyed working in the Inland Revenue, mainly because of the number of pretty girls who also worked there, I was coming to realise that office work wasn't for me. I wanted the great outdoors and to be driving with the wind in the air. I'd already purchased a battered old Triumph TR4 and loved the feel of the wind roaring past the open cockpit. That's probably why my tinnitus is so bad now. Eventually, I remarked to the gentleman who sat next to me at the desk that I was thinking of leaving. He was 64 and warned me as to the mistake I'd be making. "What about your pension when you're 65? Was his response. That did it. I was 21. And if all I'd got to look forward to was a bloody pension in 44 years' time, then I was off. And the following day, handed in my notice. I wanted to drive for a living, find my way about the place, have adventure. I had no idea how I was going to approach it, and my first effort was to apply for a job delivering Volvo cars on trade plates for a company called Car Transport out of Ipswich. There was no response to my application, and within a week, Mum was pestering me to find suitable employment. Applications to various small local transport companies also proved fruitless. I had no previous experience, you see, and a month-long holiday travelling around Europe didn't carry any weight at all. A job was advertised for a coalman at the Co-op Coal Yard in Stowmarket, and desperation forced me to apply, much to my mother's disgust. Her attitude being, "Oh no, what am I going to tell the neighbours?" Having been accepted for an interview by Mr. Bray, the Co-op General Manager, I was taken out for a test run on a newish Bedford TK3 tonner. Not much bigger than a very large car, really, and it seems the foreman was impressed enough to put a good word in for me with the management. The actual job on offer was a driver's mate, responsible for collecting the cash, and as I had just left the tax office, therefore I must know how many pennies make 10 bob. My actual driver, a guy known by the name of Mick, but with a handle of Strawberry — in fact, the family of four boys were all known as Strawberry for some unfathomable reason — was a real Jack the Lad, and well known around Stowmarket for enjoying a drink and the occasional bout of fisticuffs at the local Chinese on a Friday night. Anyway, it wasn't that long before he lost his licence for the umpteenth time, and I was promoted to driver while he was relegated to money bagman. I shan't go into details on my 8-month sojourn with the coal yard, but if you are interested, some of the tales are in my book, Not All Sunshine and Sand. Suffice to say, physically, it made a man out of me, and it gave me a great grounding in driving a relatively large vehicle. Well, it seemed large to me at the time, and even gave me that feeling of being what I thought it was like to be a big trucker. That is, until one day, around a bend on a country road near Hawley, I came face to face with a rather large old Bentley. With nowhere to pass, I tried the old, "Excuse me, mate, you'll have to reverse, as I've got a big lorry here." And his retort in a rather posh voice was, "I beg your pardon? For a start, I am certainly not your mate, or anybody's mate. I am Major Cornwallis, a local magistrate, and as far as I can see, my Bentley is hardly any less commodious than your rather minuscule lorry. And if you don't blasty well move, man, I shall be having a word with your Mr. Bray." All said with a view over his pince-nez specs and down his nose. By that time, another vehicle had pulled up behind the Bentley, and I was forced to refrain from further confrontation, and with the threat of Mr. Bray ringing in my ears, was made to reverse a good 50 yards into the entrance of a field. As much as I enjoyed the experience of working as a coalman, it was never going to be a long-term choice for my future employment. So, seeing an advert in the Stowmarket Chronicle for a lorry driver — these were the days before the term HGV came into common usage — I applied for a job with a well-established local haulier, George Thorpe of Middlesham. Thorpe's was a proper old-fashioned transport company with a mixed fleet of cattle floats, flatbeds and sugar beet trailers, a genuine haulers company designed to serve the local agricultural community. Of a fleet of around 25 lorries, three were out on general tramping duties, the rest mostly on day work, carting grain, fertiliser and livestock. Here was my chance to do some real driving. At last, I couldn't wait to go tramping. Of course, that's not quite how it works. You don't go from being a new boy to being top dog just because you've driven a coal lorry and attended grammar school. The first 2 weeks of my employ, as the sugar beet season wasn't far away, I was entrusted to waft a paintbrush in the direction of the beet trailers. Then it was a week learning how to rope and sheet correctly, tie dollies, or gates as they were known in this part of East Anglia, and how to fold a 60-foot by 30-foot sheet tidily. Not such an easy task when the wind is trying its best to rip it from your grasp, and there's no one to help. Anyway, all this was essential training to me becoming a lorry driver of the year. Finally, early one sunny morning, after driving the few miles from home in Stowmarket to the yard, I was let out on my own. I fired up the old TK and pootled out of the depot, heading towards the village of Assington, between Colchester and Sudbury, to collect my first load, apples from a farm that ran an apple orchard alongside its normal farming activities. I'd been issued with numerous coils of jute rope and a set of 8 barge boards. These were 2 parallel 6-foot lengths of timber, 6 inches wide, joined together with 2 strips of thick hessian. Back in the day, almost 60 years ago, apples came off the farm, not in the huge half-ton boxes that we see today, but in the small trays that you find in your local greengrocers, and it was the driver's job to stack them carefully on the bed of the lorry. Most of you wouldn't know, but those little boxes were designed in such a way as to sit on top of each other, and interlinked so as not to fall inside the one below and damage the apples. Well, that was the idea. But as with most things farming, Equipment is used multiple times and not always treated with the decorum that such important pieces of apparatus should be, considering their importance in the scheme of things. Anyway, having done my best and stacked the apple boxes 15 high, as instructed, my next job was to tie them down, ready to deliver them to Alderby factory near Beccles in Norfolk.
Oh, Beccles in Suffolk.
Oh, yeah, sorry, yeah, Suffolk. Yeah, yeah. So much for my map reading. Alderby apple factory near Beccles in Suffolk, about 60 miles away. Well, of course, slinging a rope over each individual set of trays was going to wreck the top layer and have apples falling into the road. And this is where the barge boards came in. Of course, by the time you've loaded, the farmer has disappeared and left to do something far more important. And this is where I learnt my first lesson. Lay the barge boards along the top row crates as you go along. Do not leave the job until you're loaded. Somehow, with the help of a kindly farm labourer passing them up, I was able to clamber up the side rail and, perching precariously, reach up and sort of lay the boards along the edge of the trays. It was a very slow drive to Alderby, as once on the move, a load of small apple-filled crates, even when tied down securely, has a tendency to sway over undulating roads, and especially around corners. And it's not until you've had a live load aboard that you realise roads have cambers. The first time is a real heart-in-the-mouth experience. Having eventually found my way there, well over 2 hours later, load happily virtually intact, I removed all the ropes and stood on the tail of my lorry, while a roller ramp was wheeled out and I fed the crates of apples onto that. By one instruction from old Fred Thompson, another of our rigid drivers, was to under no circumstances enter the warehouse, as I was unlikely to come out alive and fully clothed, as the building was alive with voracious women more than happy to take you down a peg or two. That summer, other than loading bag fertiliser from Fison's on Ipswich dock on the odd occasion, collecting apples was all I did. But I loved it, because of the sense of freedom it offered. Thorpe's main office included a small corridor, where drivers' notes for the following day were placed in individual pigeonholes, with the vehicle's registration written on them. So until the end of the week, it was rare to see anyone other than another driver making an early start. The summer of 68 was wonderful. Early morning starts with the sun burning off any mist was a joy. And by the end of August, I was an expert in carting apples from all over East Anglia to Alderby. And the almost 3 hours of my first trip was reduced to an hour and a half. And I still hadn't plucked up the courage to enter Alderby factory warehouse. Looking back, the great thing about proper old transport companies like George Thorpe was their patience. They were investing their future in you, hopefully for the long term, and were prepared to give you time to learn the job properly. At the end of the apple season, I was upgraded. I put in that word in inverted commas as well. To an ancient Bedford TK six-wheeler. An old four-wheeler that had some time or other been extended with an extra axle to increase the payload, but without any increase in engine capacity. I was now going to drive a 16-tonner around the relatively flat roads of East Anglia. It was okay. Slow and steady would about cover it. Officially, it was designated as a tipper with removable sides, and most of my work was either bulk fertiliser out of Fison's or sugar beet when the campaign started. This was a time of year I detested, as it was the era when many of the farms still relied on the old-fashioned method of loading sugar beet on lorries with a beet fork. Basically an oversized garden or pitchfork on steroids, with round blobs of metal soldered onto the ends of the tines. This to ensure that when you were went to shovel up a pile of sugar beet, the tines didn't pierce the bloody things. It was a hell of a job to remove one once impaled on the end of a damaged tine, and usually involved the use of a large hobnail boot. This was backbreaking work. And whereas the older drivers were sent to farms that had tractors with buckets to load the lorries, me, being young and reasonably fit, always ended up at some old boy's farm who didn't believe in this modern technology stuff and spent anything up to 3 or 4 hours slinging fork loads of beet over the sides of my lorry before I was ready to head to Ipswich Sugar Beet Factory.
A bit different now then, with a mouse that will load a truck in 8 minutes.
A mouse?
Yeah. One of the machines is called a mouse. It's a German, I think it is, or Danish. It looks sugar beet harvester or loader, and it's looks like a combine with like a conveyor belt that runs in the trailer, and they just move the conveyor belt, dropping the sugar beet in, and that'll load 29 ton in about 8 minutes.
So you don't do anything at all?
No, you lift the buck up to weigh it, and that's it. So you've gone from 3 or 4 hours to 5 minutes.
I remember it wasn't so much with the pitchforks, though, because you couldn't really put a lot of mud in the trail, but occasionally we were sent to farms where they had a type of griddle thing, where there was a bloke with a bucket.
Yeah.
And he'd drop these on a griddle.
Yeah.
But so occasionally they got rid of the griddle, and the bloke just shoved it, drove his bucket into the pile of
beet,
and put the whole lot into the straight. Of course, I think, I've seen the sugar beet factory must have got used to, because eventually it got to the stage where they used to put a tester in to see him.
To a sample, yeah. A
sample test, maybe.
Yeah.
And I think they got paid by the amount of beet, actually, not the amount of mud.
Yes.
So there was how much mud went into the back of a trailer in early days.
Yeah.
But, they were just bringing those griddle things in, those griddle...
cleaner loader, call them.
Cleaner loader,
So it shakes all the mud off. Yeah. Should do, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was by far and away the youngest bloke there, and there were still one or two old farms, small.
Yeah.
Small, almost like allotment type farm.
It was like a small holding.
Small holding, almost, yeah. And, I was fortunate enough to be sent to those to load up. Now, but you look back and you think, you know, I'm sure you didn't do me any harm. At the time, you're never very happy about that sort of thing, are you? But looking back, it's just part of the process of learning to do the job.
Yeah.
And in all honesty, they were never going to send a 60-year-old out to do that sort of thing.
No.
So, yeah, right. In all honesty, transport was still very much in the dark ages. There were very few fat, or maybe should I say corpulent drivers about, and definitely no women, as the work was physically extremely demanding. The use of pallets and forklifts was still in their infancy, certainly in the world of agriculture. Farmers weren't predisposed to spend cash when there were available hands to do the work, usually yours. It was nothing to do two loads of handball fertiliser out of Fison's a day to various farms, handballed on when loading, handball off at the farm, often on your own. Just put them in that there barn there, driver, was the usual instruction before the old boy wandered off to milk his pigs or whatever he did next. 40 tonne of handball a day was quite usual, and when I moved up to Arctic, it was more like 60 to 80 tonnes a day. Maybe that's why my shoulder is a bit arthritic these days. Anyway, I'm getting a bit ahead of myself. To be honest, the old TK was well past its sell-by date, and I was hoping to be offered one of the newer 22-ton AEC Marshalls before long. Anyway, still more lessons to learn about this idiosyncratic industry. In the February of 69, I was given my first long-distance job since starting at Thorpe's, a full load of bulk fertiliser from Fison's of Ipswich to their storage facility at Birmingham. This to include a night out. Well, I was totally made up. This was what I wanted, not stuck in some crummy old office, even if the girls were of the attractive variety. It was down to Ipswich to load up, along with a plastic bag full of old towels and scraps of material. Back then, multi-purpose vehicles with demountable sides and rears weren't exactly watertight, and it would be nothing to be following such a vehicle with a torrent of granules or grain pouring through gaps in the superstructure, mainly from the ill-fitting tailgate. The reason for the materials? To stuff the multitude of cracks. The route to Birmingham takes you across the flatlands of East Anglia, via King's Lynn, across the Fens to Boston, before arriving at the southern end of the Lincolnshire Wolds, a range of hills that I would have to navigate before arriving at my destination. You wouldn't even notice them nowadays in your 750-horse Scanias or Volvos. It had been a slow but steady run so far, but on leaving Spilsby on the A16, the road reared up in front of me like Mount Everest, or so it seemed. Before I'd hardly started the climb, I was down in second gear, and as I said earlier, although the old TK had been extended to increase its load capacity, the mechanics hadn't been extended to improve the performance. I think I might have managed half distance up the slope, steadily losing power before I tried changing to first. Of course, the act of dipping the clutch meant that the old lorry lost any minuscule forward motion it had, and I was stranded on the hill. The transmission handbrake wasn't sufficient to restrain the fully freighted 16-ton Bedford, and I was stuck holding the handbrake with one foot on the foot brake. Panic would be putting it mildly. Somehow I managed to engage first gear, and letting the clutch out went nowhere, as the smell of burning asbestos filled the cab. My only choice was to try and reverse back down the bank. A sweat-inducing experience, I can tell you, attempting to keep a straight line as I edged back down the steep slope. Bum-squeaking time it certainly was. Finally, I was at the bottom and trying to recover from the ordeal, because that's what it was. Even my underpants were soaking from the amount of sweat I had expended. Eventually, I plucked up courage to select first and attacked the hill again, this time at no more than 3 miles an hour. It was a long, slow drag to the top of the bank, as with the old engine screaming in pain and anger, I eventually made the brow. The old girl stank of mechanical smells from the effort she had made, and I was saturated with perspiration, with my heart thumping away in my chest like a single pot lister. So this is what lorry driving is all about. The world is apparently not all flat like East Anglia. Reporting back to the office on my return, saw the old Bedford being retired to the graveyard at the bottom of the yard, and me being promoted to an F-reg Bedford KM within a fortnight. At last, a lorry with a letter off the registration number. No more pre-1963 registered underpowered 10-year-old Bedfords for me. Here at last was a proper six-wheeler with a two-speed axle, a primrose lifting rear axle, and eight gears. What more could a budding big wheel lorry driver ask for? The fact that it was really the old TK cab dressed up to look the part, with twin headlights, a double height front bumper, and a more powerful engine, all of 130 brake horsepower now, was irrelevant. Now I was going to join the proper drivers, delivering loads all over the country, or so I thought.
So do you know what the horsepower roughly of the previous...
About 90.
About 90.
Yeah.
So you left about 40. So you left about 40 horsepower.
The old six-wheeler. Was the,
yeah.
Yeah, 40 horsepower more, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, when you talk... I know, actually, because you were 22 ton now, not 60, but they were built differently, weren't they? The originally, the old, that TK would have been a 10-tonner.
Yeah.
As a four-wheeler. An extra axle on the back, gave it an extra 6 ton.
Yeah.
But with that, I think it were 330s. I think the engine was what they call a 330.
Yeah.
Which was, I think, really designed for the old four-wheelers and what have you.
Yeah.
The KM was 500, right. So like horsepower. It's obviously a more powerful, even though it's 130 horsepower, which it doesn't sound much, does it now, when you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
That was a lot more powerful. It was almost as good as an AC equivalent sort of thing.
Yeah.
Not quite, but it was almost as good.
Yeah.
A lot easier to drive, as you know, if you've driven a TK. I mean, that was like driving a large car. They were quite advanced in terms of truck driving for drivers back in the day. Most soft gearboxes, and they didn't have the suspension seats, whatever, but they were just like driving a big car, whereas once you got to an Atkinson or something, right, you're talking about a different kettle of fish altogether.
Yeah.
Right, so where were we? Yes, now I was going to join the proper drivers living loads over the country, so I thought, yes. In fact, nothing much changed in my work pattern. There was still the fertiliser to deliver, along with the odd load of Stramit board from High Airfield, and that was something else. Stramit was basically wood chip, or similar, flat packed and compressed between two shiny lengths of melamine covered 3-ply. And to say that it was loading like loading sheets of large flat ice cubes on top of one another wouldn't be far from the truth. Many a load of Stramit board was to be found deposited over outlying parts of the United Kingdom back in the day. It was almost impossible to keep it tied in successfully, even with a sheet holding it in place. Fortunately, the majority of loads were allocated to the Arctics. Along with the KM came a demountable body, tipper body with a donkey engine called a Templin. I presume that was the manufacturer's name. This meant that I spent more time loading imported corn out of Paul's Malt off the quay at Ipswich Docks. And you know what it's like, loading the same stuff day after day, every day. You soon get to know when you're fully freighted, as you allow the grain to fill up to a certain mark inside the tipper body. And within a week or two, every time I pulled round from the quay onto Paul's Weybridge, I was within a couple of hundred right at my maximum weight, which in my case was now 22 tons. But there's always the one occasion when you learn the hard way. Came the day I was instructed to go to Paul's yet again, this time to load maize off the quayside. Of course I will. An expert at loading grain-type materials now, aren't I? There I was in the quayside queue, waiting my turn, whilst chatting to other drivers from Downey's, Giles, and a couple more of our own, and not one of them mentioned the word maize. Eventually it was my turn, and I pulled under the flexible downpipe that you control by swishing it up and down along the body. as I watched the tub slowly fill and kept an eye on the mark that meant for me I was full. I pulled the cord that closed off the funnel when I thought it was done. Back in the cab, I selected first, and as I pulled away, thought she felt a bit heavy, as the old suspension creaked and groaned a lot more than normal. The Weybridge yard where I was headed, also held the bunkers where incoming loads of corn from region's farms were deposited. And today it was full of lorries of all shapes and sizes, tipping whatever grains they were carrying. Chris, a guy I played rugby against on the odd occasion, was operating the Weybridge. And as I jumped out of the cab and entered the office, he pointed at the scales. "What the hell have you done, Paulie boy?" as I glanced across to see it registered at a fraction under 37 tonnes, 15 tonne overweight. "Bloody hell, mate. Didn't you realise the maize was a heavy grain?" "Obviously not," I said. "Can I tip the excess into the hopper?" "No, that would be the normal procedure. But as today was so busy, I'd have to wait at least 2 or 3 hours for a space on the grid." "Bugger it," I thought. "I'm going to take it as it is." And that is what I did, creaking and groaning all the way along the old single-track A45 to Bury St Edmunds. Never got anywhere near Top Gear, other than dropping down Walpit Hill, and struggled to get over 30 most of the way. But if you were to ask any lorry driver about their earlier experiences in the business, you would get a similar response, well, at least from the honest ones. In early 1970, the government introduced legislation requiring all lorry drivers to obtain a specific licence appertaining to the vehicle they were driving. And by now, I had, on the odd occasion, taken an Artic out on the road, so I was fully expecting the old man to sign me off for the Class 1 licence. There were actually 4 classes at the time. Class 1 for articulated vehicles, Class 2 for 6 and 8 wheeler rigids, Class 3 for 4 wheelers, and Class 4 for stuff like Scammel Scarab 3 wheel tractor units that usually worked in restricted environments like railway yards, etc. There was an anomaly in that any of the rigid licence holders could also pull a trailer if so required, without having to obtain a Class 1 licence. But if so, we're still restricted to 30 miles an hour until well into the 1980s. To my shock and horror, I was the only employee at the company, other than the secretary and the office assistant, not to be signed off for a Class 1. I couldn't believe it. Even the company accountant, who had never driven any commercial vehicle in anger, received a brand spanking new black HGV licence. George's view was that as he paid into the RTIGB levy, he needed to get some benefit out of it. And as I was by far the youngest employee on the books, I was going to have to take a test. In fact, all my lessons were taken in the old KM, as the RTITB, Road Traffic Industry Training Board, which had only been officially open since February, still hadn't received its full complement of instruction vehicles. Anyway, 3 weeks later, I had passed the Class 2 test with fortunately not too much further tuition, and I was almost immediately booked in for a Class 1 course. These were times of massive changes in the transport industry. Containerisation was coming to Felixstowe, and British transport wasn't always ready for it, as many a lorry would turn up at 72 Park without the correct equipment to transport them. By that, I mean without twist locks, which is how containers are designed to be transported. Hauliers arrived with all sorts of flatbeds, many of which looked as if they had been hosed off and towed off a farm. 20-foot and 40-foot boxes were chained on, or even on odd occasions, in my case, roped on, by tying rope from the box section where the twist lock was supposed to sit to one of the hooks welded under the lorry bed. These hooks were rated at maybe 1 ton each, and a row of 20 down each side of the lorry back were actually spot welded on for roping and sheeting purposes, not loading containers. Rope tied through the 4 corner locks into 4 hooks sat adjacent to them were never going to prevent a 10-ton container from doing its thing in emergency situations. But that is how we worked, until rigid and trailers were converted to take said twist locks. It was nothing to see an Artic pulling a 33-foot trailer with a 40-foot container chained on the back. All these physical changes to the way transport was heading made any sensible driver approach a job with discretion and a certain amount of circumspection. 1968 had seen the government pass legislation to implement what became known as the O licence, which in theory was going to establish a new, de-restricted, professional, updated framework for the haulage industry of the future to work within. Well, that was the plan anyway, But like much in the way of lawmaking, it had its ups and downs. Prior to 68, the industry had been run utilising what were known as A, B and C licences, of which the A licence was king. Simply put, A licences allowed the haulier free rein to load anything, from anywhere to anywhere. Whereas the B licence, though similar to the A licence in terms of haulier's ability to load from any business, was only allowed to deliver within a limited mileage. The C licence was for only count stuff only. Any transport business was valued by the number of A licences it held. Of course, by far the largest haulier back then was British Road Services, and their depots full of red lorries with white sign writing can be found in virtually every small town and city in Britain. I believe they had at least 150 main depots. Rapidly to become an anachronism in this newly competitive world of post-68 O-licence haulage, they were a throwback to the post-war days of 1947, when the whole of the transport industry, road, rail, bus and waterways, were nationalised by the Transport Act. So the updated Transport Acts of 68 and 70 were the new frontiers for a modern, vibrant transport industry. But in many ways, instead of conquering the old Wild West, to use a poor analogy, it seemed as if the industry became the new Wild West. Out went the old bib braces and boiler suits of A, B and C days, and almost overnight, or so it seemed, in came jeans, t-shirts and riggers boots, or if you were a continental driver, furry clogs. If I remember correctly, the phrase used to enable one to receive an O licence was that the applicant had to be a fit and proper person with a certain level of financial stability, a suitable base to operate from, and have a man that held a CPC, Certificate of Professional Competence, to run the operation. All pious, sensible requirements, full of good intentions, you would think. Not sure that's how it turned out, as I remember talking to George a few years later, and as an old established business, he hadn't a good word to say about the new legislation, and reckoned that rates had almost halved in the past 5 years. It was a well-known fact that as well as newly established owner drivers, like John Goodwin, for example, who genuinely wished to make a successful business in this brave new world of de-restricted transport, that there were numerous cowboys after a quick buck, or so they thought. Jack the lads, who thought that utilising other people's facilities, riding on the back of someone else's CBC, would allow them to cut rates and make a million. Itinerant drivers came up with all sorts of weird and wonderful ideas as to how to make their fortune. I remember chatting to a couple of likely lads at Felixstowe Routemasters, a well-known truck stop back in the day, who had purchased a brand new Scania 110 with what seemed almost unheard of back then, a sleeper cab, and whose intention was to work the vehicle non-stop, double manning where necessary, while running on someone else's O-licence and based at someone else's depot. No idea what happened to them, but even with my limited knowledge of the industry at the time, I thought it was a bit risky.
You're listening to the Truck and Driver podcast brought to you by TomTom. The TomTom Go navigation offers a specific set of truck features. You can set your cargo and truck dimensions for specific routes so you can drive confidently on suitable roads, making every journey efficient and reliable. Truck yeah.
This sort of attitude in this new world of late post-war transport was common. Maybe George was right. Gone were the days of the silent check by ministry man hiding covertly in the clock tower at the top of Newmark High Street, only to turn up at your depot weeks later demanding to look at your log sheets for a particular day. Now, with the new legislation in place, everything in the industry was being tightened up, and any misdemeanour meant a visit to plead your case in front of the god, the traffic commissioner.
So the ministry man used to hide in Newmarket Clock Tower.
That was one of the places.
Yeah, and just write down company names and times.
Yeah, and then weeks later he'd appear, it would be weeks later as well, he'd appear at your yard demanding to look at, and it wouldn't just be you, he might have spent a few hours in the clock, Clock Tower, have you ever seen the clock?
Something roundabout, is that what
you
mean?
Yeah. Tiny place, yeah. And then obviously there were various other places throughout the country they used to hide. I'm not sure it's a job I'd have wanted, but that was the way they checked on people. Silent check.
Yeah.
That's right, yeah. Back then it wasn't tackers, was it? It was
logbooks.
In fact, the initial logbooks didn't have serial numbers. They were just just log sheets.
Right.
Eventually, they thought, of course, people just did rip out a chair and throw away, would fill another one up at the end of the day. And so there's no proper checking on it. And then eventually, they put serial numbers on, so it had to be sequential.
Yeah.
Just a way of tying it. Because you're not a lorry driver, so like you've been it long enough to yourself. If there's a way to get around something, you'll learn about
it.
It's a weird industry, it really is.
Yeah.
Right. There is no doubt that there were earthquake-sized changes taking place in an industry that may well have become stagnant. Not only was legislation altering the structure of the industry, the influx of new idealistic young owner drivers was changing the vehicle purchasing habits as well. Whereas the old, well-established companies, a lot of whom had started as farmers delivering their own produce back in the 1950s, were still purchasing British-manufactured vehicles, such as AEC, Atkinson, ERF, Guy and Leyland, often fitted with the ubiquitous Gardner engines, that in all honesty were well past their sell-by date in terms of product development, the new breed of self-employed lorry drivers were starting to appreciate the much more refined, driver-friendly offerings arriving from Europe, like Scania, Volvo, MAN and Mercedes, with synchro gearboxes, actual cab heating, and comfortable pneumatic seating. No more crash gearboxes, no more drafty old cabs, with the wind blowing up your trouser leg from the holes in the floor where the gear lever and clutch pedal was fitted. No more carrying half your mother's spare bedding to keep warm on a freezing cold day. No more damaged spines from the continual buffeting that an unsuspended seat offered. Here at last were modern vehicles that were more like large cars in the way they drove and the levels of comfort they offered. Anyway, enough of that potty's history and back to my timeline. As I said, I'd been booked in to take my Class 1, and over the next week, my instructor, Herbie Green, wrapped my knuckles on more than one occasion for allowing my trailer wheels to mount a curb on a tight kerb. "You might have killed some poor old lady there," he'd say in his Suffolk accent, as he'd batter the back of my hand with a ruler. He'd have made a very good headmaster. These were the very early days of HGV tuition, and sadly, members from RTITB were of the old school in terms of vehicle selection. The only articulated lorry on the premises was a brand new AEC Mandator with a new 272 horsepower Leyland engine and a 12-speed gearbox. At the end of that week, I did indeed manage to pass my test, though not without a certain amount of anxiety, caused in no small part by the gear change requirements of the exam back then. Not sure they still apply. Do they still apply?
No, because, well, if you can find a manual truck to do it.
Oh, right.
There isn't, no one has a manual, so...
Right.
Your forward test is just go forward for an hour, basically. You obviously have a reversing exercise.
Yes, yeah.
It has to be passed and signed off before you can go out and do your forward test. Yeah, you can't do it vice versa. There's no gear exercise. You still have your uphill, downhill, and angled start.
Yeah,
but no actual... Because when I did my test as well, you had to go up.
Another box.
Yeah, I think there's... The Arctic test I did was in a DAF 75, I think it was, an old super truck motor, and it was, I think it was an 8-speed, but I can't remember exactly, but I do remember having to do the gear check. I think I had to get up to fourth gear and then back down.
Oh, just fourth?
I think it was, right. from memory.
Where did you do that? Was it in
Chelmsford? I did all my test training, because I worked for CAMAX out of Earlscoe.
Oh, yeah, of course you did, yeah.
So that was the closest one. So yeah, my test route was dead easy. It was out of Chelmsford Test Centre, through like the industrial state, down the old A12, past Rovers Cath.
Yeah, down the roundabout.
Yeah, onto the A12, down the A12 to the M25 junction,
come back
through Brentwood, and then as I come through Brentwood for a bit of town work, and then do my hill start and all that lot, back on the A12, back up the old A12, past Rovers Cath, and back in the test centre.
Right.
Lovely.
That wasn't the same in Ipswich, because the test centre in Ipswich used to be where it was now, actually.
That's right, on the hill.
Housing estate.
Yes.
And that wasn't the easiest place at all.
No.
Especially coming out.
Yeah.
Okay, right. So, as I mentioned earlier, the RTITB were not in the market to purchase modern vehicles at this stage of the development. And as with a normal Mandator, this gearbox was also of a constant mesh variety. In simple terms, a crash box. An integral part of the test was to prove your ability in changing through all those gears, both up and down the box, without missing a change. 24 in all. Which would be a fail if you did, as you would not have been considered to have been in control of your vehicle. The full story is in my biography under the chapter title, Crunch and Graunch, because that's what it was. A litany of mechanical chaos as I attempted to master the art of timing and silent changes under pressure from an examiner. If he wasn't partially deaf prior to my attempt, he certainly would have had a head full of tinnitus after my pathetic effort. Somehow, at the end of the hour-long test, I held the pink slip in my hot little hand and was shaking hands with the examiner as he told me I had in fact passed. Within weeks, I'd been allocated a 1964 Atkinson Silver Knight with 205 coming horses under the bonnet and mated to a David Brown 6-speed gearbox and was trunking up and down the highways and byways of Britain, visiting places I'd heard of but never seen. My copy of the Headlight magazine was my Bible, as it held information on drivers' digs and clearing houses that offered return loads. I absolutely loved the freedom. My only instruction from the office was to inform them of the rate for any load that I was offered before it was accepted. For the next year or so, other than fertiliser delivery season, where it was all hands to the tiller, providing nitrogen to the farmers of East Anglia, this was my life. Nights away from home were more commonplace than not. At this time, the majority of drivers were still sleeping in digs, some much less salubrious than others. The price quoted usually gave some idea as to the quality of the accommodation and the number of bugs in the mattresses. 7 and 6 for a bed at the infamous Scotch Corner bore no comparison to Mrs. McBrain's voluptuous middle-aged chest and £1.2 and 6 for a full homemade roast dinner and a comfy bed in a shared room in Aberdeen. In 1973, a brand new Guy Big J appeared in the yard, also fitted with the 205 Cummings, but this time hooked up to the ubiquitous Fuller 9-speed range change, a marvellous gearbox. I was still the youngest employee at Thorpe's, and well down the seniority list in terms of being offered a new vehicle. But this was an old-fashioned company, with its roots set back in the early 50s, and everything was done by the board. All new vehicles arriving in the yard were offered by strict rote. One-eyed Fred Page, the senior driver, always had first choice. But he was a committed AEC mandated driver, and our Arctic fleet was 99% of that mark. In fact, none of the drivers above me were in the slightest bit interested, and so it fell to Keith, the transport manager, to offer it to me. I grabbed the opportunity with both hands. Even though it had a fixed seat, it had a decent heater, a padded dashboard, and a Philips radio. What more could a young green behind the ears trunker aspire to, other than add a number plate to the front bumper with the epithet Easy Rider imprinted on it? A really cool American film of the time. I took to it like a duck to water. The only thing that it kept raising its head was that I wanted to travel even further afield. The fact that we were an island was a very frustrating limiting factor. I wanted to go abroad if possible. My trips to the north of Scotland, West Wales, and almost to Land's End were not satisfying an itch that kept bothering me. I had mentioned to George on the odd occasion that it would be marvellous to do a bit of continental. His response wasn't very encouraging. "We make a very good living in this country, young man. Why on earth would I want to send my lorries across the channel to strange foreign countries? I suggest you put those ideas to rest, my boy." But I kept niggling away at Keith, and one day, out of the blue, I was instructed to bounce solo down to Dover and collect a continental trailer, one with a tilt apparently. I asked where it was going. "I don't know. I suggest you take your passport just in case," said Keith. I couldn't keep my excitement in check and hardly slept the night before. In the morning, with a bulging suitcase, I was up at the crack of dawn, heading down the A12 towards Brentwood and the A128 through Orsett towards the Dartford Tunnel. This was a time before the M25 was opened. "I wonder where I'm going," kept running through my mind as I dropped down into Dover and into the Eastern Docks. This is where my dream was shattered. As I handed over paperwork with details of the trailer I was to collect, only to find that La Continent was not the final destination at all, but somewhere up in north it was. "But I thought I was going abroad," I said to the bloke behind the desk. He laughed. "No, son, it's just arrived from abroad. This was just the start of my misery. As I wrote in my book, it was certainly a beautiful trailer, relatively new, bright yellow, with the owner's name emblazoned on the side." Then came the start of another huge learning curve. As I commented earlier, these were the early days in this modern new world of British transport. and it in no way applied more than to this relatively new concept of pulling unaccompanied foreign trailers from the docks. And it wasn't just a case of hooking up and off you go. Oh no. For a start, many European tilts had kingpins that were set too far back for British lorries to connect to without hitting the rear of the cab. Fortunately, in my case, this was not so. And having borrowed a handle with a bolt from a tug driver to wind the legs down sufficiently so that I could hook up to it, did just that. The standard British hexagon handles that fitted all British manufactured trailers were as much use as an ashtray on a motorbike, as these trailers came with a round spindle-shaped winding mechanism with a hole drilled in it. Having finally coupled up, I was faced with my next problem, as I jumped onto the catwalk to hook up the airlines, only to find that our British male-female connectors had nothing to connect to. What was there was a strange-looking mechanism that bore no resemblance to anything I recognised. Once again, it was call on a friendly tug driver to explain the system. These probably were the days when tug drivers were friendly. Of course, I had none of the tools to complete the job. None at all. Boy, was this different to what I expected. He very kindly fetched a spare European coupling attached to a male English end and showed me how to attach a palm coupling. "Only give you one, mate," he said. "Shouldn't really give you this." And with that, he was off, and I was left to connect the male end to my red line. Of course, the electric Suzy didn't match up either, and I was left a forlorn, defeated, unfulfilled Continental driver, basically in the doo-doo. As I'd only got the one airline fitted, it meant I had no trailer brakes. I mean, no electric connection, no rear trailer lights. I had two choices. I could either leave the trailer there or attempt to get it home. Without thinking of the consequences of that action, that is what I did. To receive a massive bollocking when I drew up in our yard later that day. How I didn't get a pull on route, I've no idea, as back then there seemed to be a lot more police cars on the road. Not only that, but of course, by the time I pulled into the yard, the poor old guy's brakes were totally knackered with the effort trying to hold a 14-ton trailer in check. I was sent home on a type of suspension until the lorry's brakes had been realigned and the fitters had made up an electrical bypass to enable the trailer to have working lights. George's response to what had occurred was simple, as I was called into the office on my return to work a couple of days later. "Now, my boy, see how much this continuous demand of yours to go Continental has cost me? What with having to repair your lorry and the lost earnings," as he raised his voice. "I do not want the word Continental used in my presence in the future. Do you understand me?" Secretly chastised, I was dismissed and sent off to deliver the loaded tilt. Of course, as I mentioned earlier, transport was changing. European road haulage was already far ahead of the UK and had been using tilt trailers for years. I'd even remembered seeing them on the road when we had lived in Holland, Germany, back in the mid-50s. Logically, it was the way forward, as roping and sheeting is a very time-consuming way of protecting your load from the elements. But it wasn't until railroad ferries were introduced to cross-channel operations that the idea came to Britain big time. No matter what George had said, even he could not stop the rapid march of progress. UK transport, which for years had lolled in the dark ages, was finally catching up. And those Continental tilt trailers he saw aboard were starting to arrive at Felixstowe, where millions of pounds were being invested in massive development. Landguard and the Dock Basin, which for years had been the source of any work that might come out of the port, were going to be dwarfed by the vast new Trinity Terminal, which was going to be used solely for containers. Within 6 months, I was picking up tilt trailers from 77 Park on a regular basis, this time fully prepared, with a passenger footwell full of various Continental winding handles, associated bolts, bulbs and lenses, mostly half-hinged off trailers dropped in the unaccompanied park. Looking back, I can only apologise to any driver that might have turned up to hook up to a trailer, only to find that he was short of any of the stuff that might have found its way into my footwell. Sad to say, it was very much a dog-eat-dog way of life in the early days of collecting Continental trailers. And as for the rubber tilt tensioners, well, that's another story. If a trailer arrived at Felixstowe with a full complement, keeping the tilt taut, it could almost be guaranteed to have at least half a dozen or so missing by the time it came to be collected. They were such a useful piece of equipment to have in your bag of tricks, you see. From holding your transferable number plate, to, even more importantly, holding up your portable rear light board. They were a godsend. There was a major difficulty and complexity in fitting up usable lighting systems for these imported trailers due to their differing electrical connections and light covers. Every country in Europe had their own design, and often more than one. Even in Britain there were numerous different types, although the main ones were individual round cup-shaped lenses or an integrated oblong lens that covered all trailer bulbs on the rear of the trailer. To add to the difficulty, European bulbs were of the single pole variety, where ours were twin pole. To counter this problem, most hauliers that took on this type of work manufactured their own light board, fitted with British electrical fittings and lenses, 8 foot wide across to accommodate the width of the trailer, and with the light fitting set in roughly the correct position. They came with a 50 foot length of electrical cable that allowed you to couple up to the electrical Suzy from the unit. This is where the industrial sized rubber tilt tensioners came into play. 4 or 6 of those used to hold the light board in place around the rear underrun bar, or even hanging off the trailer tilt cord, meant you were legal to drive. 2 or 3 more holding the electrical cable in place along the trailer sides, and you were ready to go. So you can maybe understand the difficulties involved back in this transitional time of road haulage. Within a few months, I was being pulled by the ministry for not having a side light halfway down the trailer, which meant that our overstretched yard electrician had to integrate a side marker light into the 50-foot long cable, at least on the offside. The whole thing was very much a Fred Carno lash-up. It was during this period that I had a few more dealings via George Thorpe with Bob Carter, and during the odd sporadic conversation, understood him to say that it was his plan to start up on his own, with the intention of eventually doing continental work at some time in the foreseeable future. Of course, this made my ears prick up somewhat. I wasn't aware at the time that Bob was in fact one of the Carter brothers of W.G. Carter Transport fame, a large, well-respected haulier of the time. But due to differences of opinion, Bob had decided to break away and try his luck on his own. But this was going to be some time in the future. And in the meantime, in the spring of 74, I had been invited on holiday to family in Vancouver. Conversation with Keith followed something along these lines. I want to book a holiday, Keith. No problem, Paul. When is that? Then I gave him the estimated dates. Not possible, Paul. Your entitlement is 2 weeks, not 7. I'll have to hand my notice in then, Keith. I mean, there's no point in flying all that way just for 2 weeks. Well, that's your decision, son. Must say I'm very disappointed. Will there be a job for me when I come back? Bloody hell, boy, you the cheek of the devil. I've no idea. With that, I went off on holiday, full of the confidence of youth that, of course, they'll have me back. I know it sounds big-headed now. With that same confidence, after 6 years in the industry, I knew now that I was half decent lorry driver. Whilst enjoying my vacation in Canada, being a lorry driver, I was able to compare the totally different types of trucks they drove, as it wasn't the same restriction in the overall length that we had in the UK. For example, the number of rigid lorries pulling trailers on immense 10-foot-long A-frame tow bars was unbelievable. The amount of extra wind resistance must have been phenomenal. Still, with fuel less than half the price it was back in the UK, maybe those costs weren't quite so important. I also noticed that a good proportion of the wagons were of the bonneted variety, and there certainly weren't any British manufactured vehicles in the road. It was all Kenworths, White Freightliners, Macks, Brockways and Peterbilts, often with huge sleeping compartments and certainly fitted with much more powerful motors. Anyway, one particular day I was in the garden with my cousins when my uncle called me in to meet a friend of his who had popped round for a chat. This friend just happened to be the transport manager of a company called Yukon Freight Lines that ran from Seattle in the States to Yukon and Alaska in the far north. It transpired during their conversation that he was a driver short for a double manned operation near Whitehorse in the Yukon. And my uncle, having mentioned that I was a truck driver from the UK, wondered if I would be interested. Bloody hell, would I be interested? An instant response of yes got me fixed up as a double driver in a cab over White Freightliner with a 10-foot sleeping compartment bolted onto the rear of the cab. In fact, the unit alone was getting off the length of my old KM Bedford. Couldn't believe my eyes when I set foot in her. And what with a huge 370-horse Cummins engine, it was like nothing I'd ever driven before. I don't know what the legislation is now, but back then you could drive on the British licence for a year before you had to take what the Canadians called an air test. It was interesting to see the differences between the way Canadian haulers worked compared to ours back home. Certainly their rigs were much larger than ours, as length didn't seem to be an important factor. But the standout thing for me was the use of straps to tie down loose loads, rather than the old roping system we had back home. It seemed so far advanced a system than our own. Every flatbed trailer was fitted with a line of ratchet spindles down the side of the buck, and each spindle was filled with a length of strap. All the driver did when they finished loading was to pull out the strap, toss it over the load as we would a rope, hook the end onto a tie bar or under the rave, and ratchet it tight. Just a simple method, and such a saving of time. Anyway, it was arranged that Bill, the driver, would pick me up on his way through the following Monday, and once out of the city and up into the sparsely inhabited part of Canada that starts about 100 miles north of the border, he would allow me to drive. Never having driven a lift hooker before, and given its overall size of over 65 feet, I was more than a little apprehensive at the thought. We were delivering equipment for the mining industry, with a return load of damaged stuff from the same place. Once I'd had half an hour or so behind the wheel, I could feel Bill start to visibly relax as I settled into the rhythm of the job. In many ways, driving on the right seems much more natural to me. Once north of the famous Hope Slide, a huge landslide that occurred 9 years previously and had taken out the original road, traffic became less and less, and the wide open freeway, surrounded by vast pine forests and high snow-capped peaks, was a pleasure to drive. Bill wasn't the most talkative of characters, and other than warning me to keep an eye out for moose and bears, settled back and let me get on with it. What an impressive machine it was, with a dashboard so full of dials that it would have made an airline pilot envious. The extended cabin, which was accessible from the cab, contained bunks, a small cooker, fridge, fold-up table and chairs, a large TV set, and walls full of cupboards. It was like having a small caravan bolted onto the chassis. The diesel tank was also fully insulated and electrically heated to cope with their bad winters. When it came Bill's turn to drive, he suggested I go to sleep in one of the bunks. But even though the view was a screen full of pine forest a good deal of the way, I was too excited by the experience. The further north we drove, the more the road surfaces became long stretches of shale, with less and less tarmac covering the sections. The scenery was stunning, with the Rocky Mountains as the perfect backdrop. The road, generally speaking, followed the interwoven valleys, but there was plenty of climbing to do as we transferred from one valley to the next. With a relatively light load and such a powerful engine, there wasn't a huge amount of gear changing to do. But I was comfortable with the box anyway, as it was just a larger version of the fuller gearbox in the old guy, with 13 gears to choose from rather than the 9 in mine. Occasionally the CB would crackle into life, and Bill would chatter away to someone up country or down in the United States. The range they could reach was amazing. The sense of isolation once up above the habitation line is strong, as the townships are far apart and small, often more akin to an inn encampment than proper settlements. For such a vast country, the second largest in the world, the majority of the population appeared to live within 200 miles of the US border. The trip went as Bill hoped it would, and 5 days and 3,000 miles later, he dropped me off outside my uncle's before heading back down to Seattle. The apparent success of the operation got me a job offer, which I was more than happy to accept. However, it meant I would have to return to the UK to start the emigration process if I wanted to set up a new life here in Canada. My Uncle David would be more than happy to sponsor me should I require it. And with that in mind, I returned to Stowmarket at the end of the 7 weeks, filled with good intentions about an exciting new future. Having set the wheels in motion as soon as I got home, I returned to George Thorpe's, asking for my job back without mentioning that it was my intention to leave again as soon as my Canadian citizenship came through.
Right. Well, we'll call that the end of part one, because we're about halfway through, roughly. And we hope you've enjoyed listening, and hope you enjoy part two.
Thank you for tuning in to the Truck and Driver podcast, proudly sponsored by TomTom. As a special thanks to our listeners for trucking through the holiday season, we're giving away 1 month free of TomTom Go Navigation Truck. Simply download the Go Navigation app and use the code TRUCKYEAH. That's TRUCKYEAH when subscribing. Safe travels, folks.